You can now hear Film Actually on Stitcher Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or WebOS device. The latest episode is always available for you. No syncing needed, no memory wasted. Don't have Stitcher? Download it for free today at Stitcher.com.
Are putting in sound equipment. We don't want to be left out of it.
We don't know anything about this gadget.
What do you have to know? It's a picture. You do what you always did. You just add talking to it.
Yeah?
Don, believe me, it will be a sensation. Lamont and Lockwood, they talk.
Well, of course we talk. Don't everybody?
It'll be much less terrifying if you just come to me.
Wolfman's got
Mars. Make love in the hammock.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Film Actually, episode 74 for the 5th of February, 2012. I am David McVeigh, and I am joined by Josh Philpott. How are you, Josh?
Sorry, I got stuck in the music. Yes, hi, I'm good.
good on you, Josh. And we're also joined by...
It's really dark in here.
Richard Gray. How are you,
Richard?
You
don't even need him anymore. We just use that, and then he never has to say anything.
Richard, how are you? Welcome back.
It's really dark in here.
Dave, stop it. Seriously.
We need the... What you need, Richard, is just that piece of music so you can play it underneath you.
It's really dark in here. Wolfman's got nard. I've always wanted to do that opening theme live, just the three of us doing it.
Well, do you know what? One week we will do that.
Dude,
thank you.
Just for the hell of it. Or as they would say in Monty Python, just for the hell of it. All right, so this is Film Actually, the official movie podcast of geekactually.com. This week we are going to review officially The Artist, but we're also going to kind of review unofficially Chronicle. We'll talk about that in the What We've Been Watching segment. And Josh, I believe you have another bargain basement film for us, which is also good to know. And of course, sure, why not? And of course, we also have our wonderful lists of five. This week, we are doing five homage films because of The Artist, obviously. But before all of that happens, let's talk about what we've been watching. And we're really only going to focus on three things this week. First, we're going to focus on the fact that Richard and I saw Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace. This morning, actually.
I already seen that film.
But this was in 3D.
We'll get to why I don't care about that later.
If that actually means anything. Richard, what did you think of it? Look, first of all, let's do some ground rules. Let's not review the film again. It's been reviewed to death. All right, everybody knows Phantom Menace. Let's talk about the 3D presentation. Is it worth your money? Have we lost Richard?
Richard?
Hello, Richard.
It's really dark in here.
I think we've
lost. Hello.
Oh, there he is. Hello, Richard.
I have no idea what happened then.
You just faded away on us.
What I actually said was, when I thought it was Wizard Annie.
It was Wizard Annie, absolutely.
I won't review it again, but I had problems with the 3D. I didn't think the 3D was that good, which surprised me from someone so technically minded as George Lucas, that this was a very, very, very average conversion.
Well, yeah, and they were. There was a lot of boasting about this conversion. They were saying ILM had brought in all the original artists to get the exact texture mapping right, and they knew exactly what the depths were supposed to be, and blah, blah, blah. When you actually sat down and watched it, the overall effect, I think, Richard, you summed it up when you actually said it just looked murky.
It did. A lot of it looked murky, and I actually took my Darth Maul 3D glasses off. That was kind of cool. That we got Darth Maul 3D glasses,
but I took those off
at one point, and I wouldn't have been able to tell that I was watching a 3D film.
Yeah, that's a problem when that happens. And
seriously, for good 10 minutes, there were certain scenes when there were like three characters standing at different distances where you actually got the sense of the 3D. But otherwise, it wasn't a very 3D.
And there's a couple of action moments like this where they're having the big sword fight at the end, and the camera pans up, and you see the big pit underneath them, and it actually has depth, and you can see it stretching right off. But these moments are few and far between.
One thing I did notice this time around was that the pod race does seem to take up a good 80% of the film.
It does. I actually found myself nodding off a little bit during the pod race. And my wonderful son, the little geek Nicholas, watched it with us today, and he was the one who made the observation that it looks like they've actually still made additions.
Yeah.
Because he said that there's a character from the Clone Wars cartoon that is currently writing right now who has been inserted into that pod race scene, who he doesn't remember from the Blu-ray. So I
honestly haven't seen the movie often enough to spot the differences the way that I do with Star Wars. You make a minor difference to Star Wars, and I'm like, oh, look, they've added that.
Yeah. Well, see, with him, he's seen Phantom Menace more times than I can count. So, because as I said before, he likes the lightsabers.
Right.
So that was his Star Wars growing up. He was quite obsessed by Phantom Menace throughout all of his early years, his formative years, as they would say. And so he spots differences right, left, and center. And he was actually noticing that things seemed a little bit longer. There was a couple of stretched out extended scenes, in particular in the pod race, which as if it wasn't long enough.
Yeah, well.
They wanted to add a little bit more to it. Anyway, look, overall, the film is still the film. If you hate the film, you're still going to hate the film. If you like the film, you're still going to like the film. I don't care. But if you're just going to see it for the 3D, it's really nothing special.
No, definitely. See? I mean, look, but the one thing, the one reason I would say to support the film, only that, not that George Lucas needs the money, but hopefully this will ultimately just see a re-release, even if 3D or not 3D, the other films in cinemas, because we haven't seen that since 1997.
Exactly, and Rick McCallum has already been public about saying that they will keep doing the 3D films as long as they make money. If they don't make money, they're going to stop. They're going to discontinue.
Yeah.
So, I would like to see episodes 4, 5, and 6 in 3D or not. I'd like to see 4, 5, and 6 back at the cinema. So, exactly. So let's at least, like, you know, kind of get there. Anyway, we also, all of us, actually, before we do this, Josh, I think you need to tell us about your bargain basement film, and then we'll talk about Chronicle. What do you reckon?
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Okay.
Welcome to Josh's Bargain Basement. Did you forget you have a theme, dude?
I kind of may have just a little bit for a second there. I wasn't ready for it. But again, that's kind of me in a nutshell today. I'm kind of not ready for everything.
No, cool. It wouldn't be you in a nutshell. It would be, oh, look at me. I'm in a nutshell. I'm stuck. How did I get into this nut?
Shut the fuck up, Danny.
Josh, it's your turn.
So anyway, good evening. This week's Bargain Basement review was one that I pulled out and just laughed immediately from the cover alone. It was called P2 Parking Terror. And I was like, I too have had terror in a parking lot. So why not check this film out? So we grabbed it off the rack and we shoved it into the DVD player, as we do, and sat down and got ourselves into the most comfortable position that we possibly could, because we knew that this was going to be a long one. And I think my first problem with this film was before I even actually got the DVD into the drive, which is when I realized Wes Bentley was in it. Now, I've decided to take up a personal vendetta against this man. Me and Dave were talking recently about the fact that this man basically came out the other end of what was a perfect career upshot, where he basically, someone lifted him up and went, "American Beauty, go!" And he shot up in the air and just didn't seem to grab hold of anything. He kind of just...
Yeah, and we talked about this before, because he was actually public in saying that he was turning stuff down right, left, and center, because he was trying to find the exact role that would be perfect for him, and he didn't want to cheapen himself and all this sort of stuff. And as I said to you before, and his next film out the gate was Ghost Rider.
Yeah. Now, you see, this is kind of the thing that I'm talking about. This guy seems to show up in the weirdest places now. You know, and some actors do this. They pick to be the underdog. They pick to always do the horror films or whatever. But I don't know, Wes isn't working for me at the moment. And this film was a perfect chance for him to sell himself, because essentially the movie is set around two people. It's him and it's this girl that he basically, and this isn't a spoiler, this is all 5 minutes sort of stuff, he basically knocks out I can't remember how. I wasn't really honestly paying too much attention at that point. But essentially, she wakes up chained to a chair having Christmas dinner with him. He's actually quite a decent host, which is where my problem with the film started happening, because the girl's a bit of a bitch, really. And so I was kind of rooting for his character because he was trying to play psycho, but it was kind of come off like angry child, like someone just needed to spank him a few more times and he would have been all right. So by the halfway mark of this film, angry child man is trying to do his best attempt at acting, which basically involves flaring his eyebrows, which I figured is kind of all that he has to offer. And by the end of the film, I was kind of almost rooting for him to put her down because she was starting to annoy me. And by the end of the film, you know, everything happened the standard way horrors do, and it was basically just a waste of my time. So very disappointed. Could have been a good film. We were talking about the fact that one of the worst things about films like this is if you don't run strong with your main two leads. If you don't do this, then you end up with a nightmare film, because essentially you're banking on the fact that the acting ability of your main characters is strong enough to sell an entire film. And this was definitely not what we got here.
Well, it sounds like a quality piece of film there, Josh. And my question is, how much did you pay for this?
I paid for $5.40.
Wow, more expensive than Cujo.
Yeah, I know. Wow. This is what made it even worse. I'm now, like, I paid like 90 extra cents for this. To hell with that.
Now, I have to say I was actually really disappointed because I went into JB Hi-Fi yesterday to look for a copy of Cujo, and the sale's off. It's at $21.
Oh, you are kidding.
No, I was really shattered.
Terrible.
So it's not bargain anymore. I don't think I'm going to go looking for P2, the parking terror, somehow.
David, this might change your mind, though. When you look at the Wikipedia entry for P2,
yeah,
they've got, like, when you read the plot, they've hyperlinked certain words in there. And if I just read them out in order, it's already got me down. Chloroform, Rottweiler, flashlight, chicken, taser, gasoline.
I'm in. All right. Yeah. Sounds good to me. All right. I think Richard may have just turned me around on this one. Not really, no. All right. I'm just making that up.
Also sounds like a fun time.
It does, not doesn't it?
Sure.
Oh, dear. All right. The other film that we watched this week, and we all saw this one, was Chronicle. Yes, let me say that one more time without slurring. Chronicle. Now, this is Josh Trank's film. This is the guy that we talked about in the news show last week who was saying that he might be doing the Fantastic Four movie, and then him saying, I have no idea what you're talking about. So, so I love that. But basically, I've actually got the IMDb page up here, so I'll read their review. I'll read their summary and see if you guys agree with this. It says, three high school friends gain superpowers after making an incredible discovery. Soon, though, they find their lives spinning out of control and their bond tested as they embrace their darker sides. I'm not sure if that's entirely accurate.
No, that's not accurate at all.
No, it's kind of half accurate, but not all of them are embracing their darker sides. Anyway, that's a whole different thing. What did you guys think of Chronicle?
Richard, do you want to start this?
Oh, sorry, I didn't realize you were waiting for me. Yeah, look, Josh and I were talking about this a bit before the show, and we're both very positive on it, and I think I'm a little bit more positive than you might be, Josh. But I really enjoyed it, and I was thinking when I saw the trailers, this could have gone completely either way. And for me, it went all the right way. So I actually really connected to the characters. I thought that none of them felt tokenistic. I thought they all felt, and then I thought the bond between them actually became a genuine one. I never felt as though that was forced, which was really, really nice to see. And when things go the way they do by the end of the film, I thought a very, very clever use of other cameras beyond the ones. It wasn't one of those films where you just see everything through the point of view of one person. You know, camera gets passed around. There's a second camera person at one point, and then other cameras are used. It felt really fresh way of doing this.
It was
kind
very
of
clever,
genre.
Is what it was. I thought it was very clever. Before Josh gives his opinion on this, I actually do have the trailer here. So let's have a little listen to this trailer, and we'll get Josh's opinion when we come back. Here you go.
You're probably going to want to get this on camera. Cha-ching, cha-ching, yeah, ba-bling, 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 ba
I don't want to do it. Dude, I don't want to do it.
Okay, are you ready? Okay, come on, do it.
Give me a countdown.
I will, okay? I promise. Ah!
Crap. Are we rolling? I'm going to get the gum. Pull it right out of his mouth.
Wait, why are we running?
I got this one. Sweet, sweet.
She's just looking at it.
This is my theory, though, is that it's like a muscle.
Watch this.
Dude! Holy crap! That's why I think we're getting stronger, you know?
She thinks it's stolen.
She has no idea.
Yes, it was the black guy this time.
Okay, so that was from the trailer from Chronicle, which is really, one of the things I really liked about this before Josh jumps in is I really liked, like Richard, I really liked the performances. I'm waiting to put you in, Josh, because I actually have a feeling that you're probably the lower end of our review. So I'm waiting to throw you in because I actually quite liked it as well. And
actually, before Josh says anything, I want to talk to you about Jesus.
You know, I can just go if that's
before Josh goes.
All right, Josh, tell me what you thought of Chronicle.
I don't know why anyone thinks I didn't like this film. Like,
you know, before you go on,
tell us why you don't like it.
No, before you go on, I gotta give you a little anecdote.
I'm
gonna give you a little anecdote. One of my coworkers has actually been listening through our shows, and he actually said to me, he goes, "Josh hates everything, doesn't he?"
That is not fair. I do not hate everything.
All right, so off you go, Josh. Tear it apart.
I don't know. Can you give me a first name of this guy?
No, I'm not letting him off.
Oh, come on. I just wanted to give him a personal fuck you. And you're on my list now, man.
I'll back you up, J-Man.
Yeah, thanks, dude. Look, I didn't hate this film at all. I actually was probably the strongest one going in. I had seen the 20 minutes of footage and had a chance to speak to Mr. Trank, which was an interesting experience. He was a very, very humble person, and he's a very this-generation director. He made it very clear when he was talking to us that there's a very good chance that whatever we say he will actually see, because he tends to actually go out and look for information on his own films.
Oh, fantastic.
He was saying that I was constantly evolving with what people knew about the film, like, you know, not changing his mind on things, but you know, you learn things as you go along, and a lot of criticisms can either be taken in the same way that criticism can be taken on anything. It's like, essentially, you look at it, does it have grounding? If it does, what can I do about it? Yeah, he really struck me as that kind of a guy. I actually also asked him questions while we were there, talking to him about the fact that I wasn't a personal fan of this kind of filming, and just basically asking how haphazard this was, and he was like, no, this was all start to finish really organized, and you really got that sense when you watch the film that they planned every step of it and that it felt like a fleshed out story. I tend to agree with Richard. I think that the characters are really well defined, and they are, none of them are Togan, and all of them are very real people and very, very, very believable characters, which is one of the reasons I like them. The only problem with this film that I had was only the same thing that I have with any film done in POV style, which is, unfortunately, towards the end, as the action breaks out into its most extreme moments, I found myself a little less intrigued than I had been for the rest of the film, only because it was kind of a bit all over the place by this stage. It was sort of camera shots were happening from any direction, and though that was a very interesting way to break away from what we had been doing for the entire film, I just felt that it meant that the action got a little bit all over the place. Like, we're busting through roofs, and there's a guy with a camera filming out his window. What's he doing there? Why is he there? No, it doesn't matter. We'll move on to the next guy who's doing a street cam, and then it's like, I wasn't really buying the speed of it all. I felt like we almost need to either move to a helicopter cam and pan out the whole scene through one shot or something like that. It's like the disruption in that just started to kind of get to me a little bit. But that would be my only issue. Apart from that, I think it's fantastic. It's the first POV film apart from Rec that I've liked.
Oh, very good. Excellent. Look, I really liked it as well. I actually thought it was actually very clever how he pulled it off with the POV cameras. I think sometimes, like you, Josh, I think sometimes he was kind of reaching for it just to figure out, we need a camera here, so how are we going to put it there? But on the most part, I think it worked very well. I thought there was a particularly well-done scene where two people are having a conversation and they're both holding a camera because they were both videotaping a party. And so the cameras are not actually at their faces. They're just holding them down at like hip height. But we're actually getting two cut shots between the two cameras during the conversation. I thought that's very clever. That's very well done. I really liked in particular the performance of the nerdy kid who is in that description. He's the one that is kind of exploring the darker side. I thought he was really good. I think that's Dane DeHaan, I think.
It is Dane DeHaan.
Yeah.
Okay, and can I just break off for a minute there? Dave, I'm going to let you finish, but I just want to put this one to Richard, and it's really quick. Dude, could that guy possibly give you hope for Akira if he was Tetsuo?
Yes.
Very good. That's very good.
Yeah. That's it, Dave. You can finish now. I just really wanted to drop that out before I forgot about it.
Yeah, no, I can buy that entirely. My two favorite actors in it were him and Michael B. Jordan, who played
Steve.
He played Steve. Yes. He's kind of like the sporty guy of them all.
He's sporty guy slash high school superstar kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I thought he was actually, out of all the characters, probably the most sympathetic character.
I really liked his character.
Yeah, me too. And I think when I do say I like Dane DeHaan a lot, let me specify that I really like him in the first half of the film. I think by the second half of the film, he's becoming a little bit cliched, but I thought the first half of the film, the way that they dealt with his outsider-ness, you know, and everything, I thought he actually handled that really well. There was a lot of angst going on in him, and I thought that's a really, really, really good performance. As I say, I think he kind of, and it's a nature of the type of film that it is, without giving spoilers, but with this situation getting more and more extreme, of course, his character got more and more extreme, so it's not quite as subtle as it was in the first half of the film. But really, I do recommend it a lot. I think this is a film that is going to appeal to a lot of people.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So
no,
and if you are worried about that whole, you know, found footage type film, that's not this film.
The other thing I just wanted to bring up is I saw this on a Saturday during the middle of the day, and this is really going to be a teen hit, man. The cinema was packed.
Oh, really?
And it was all a teenage thing, and they were doing all those teenage annoying things that they do, like the shush battle at the start of a film, and the really sort of like, oh, every time something cute happens, and the laughing every time something funny happens. And then my favorite thing, and the thing that I was actually quite proud of, is they all got up and cheered as they were leaving.
Well, that's good.
And I was like, right on. I can get in on that.
Speaking of cheering, just to take this back a step, do you remember that this morning, Richard, the film ended and there was kind of this sporadic...
Star Wars, of course. Yeah,
it was like people going, "Should we?
Should we?" I mean, I don't know. We need to see Jar Jar again.
I thought that was really funny. It was like nobody could quite decide whether they should or they shouldn't. I'm glad.
I don't want to get back to Star Wars. I just wanted to say, what the hell? This is something my girlfriend Susan said to me throughout the movie. What the hell was Lucas thinking? You know, when he introduced Jar Jar and the Gungans and the whole thing, because they're just ridiculous characters.
They are. They're absolutely ridiculous.
And they haven't improved with age. Anyway, sorry, beside the point. Another Fox film, Chronicle.
Back to Chronicle. Look, everybody, avoid Star Wars in 3D. Go see Chronicle. Fox will make money one way or the other.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So I think, look, in this way, Fox will make the money, but George Lucas won't.
That's what we call win-win.
Absolutely. All right. Let's move on to our feature review. Quick summary. Josh, recommend?
Definitely.
Richard, recommend?
Definitely.
Me, definitely. Go see it. Well, we're seeing. Okay. Now, our feature review, though. Now, it was really hard because we had two films come out this week that were both really good films, big, important films. Try to decide which one. And we kind of went... With all of its Academy Award nominations, The Artist is kind of quote-unquote the more important film, I guess is one way of putting it. So we made that the feature review. That's why it is where it is. All right. So, so The Artist. Hollywood 1927. As silent movie star George Valentin wonders if the arrival of talking pictures will cause him to fade into oblivion. He sparks with Pepe Miller, a young dancer set for a big break. This is directed by Michael Hazan. And how do you pronounce his name?
I'll do it. It's Hazanavicius.
Thank you.
Michel Hazanavicius.
Wow, very good. Can you actually do the rest of these for me then? And it stars...
It stars Jean Dujardin.
Yep.
And I haven't got her other name.
It's Bernice
Bale. I
haven't
got her name in front of me at the moment, so I'll have to look at it. It's Berenice from memory.
Bale.
Yeah, Berenice Bejo.
Bejo. Is it Bejo or Bejo?
Bejo, possibly.
In Spanish, it would be Bejo, but in French, I'm not sure. John
Bejo,
Goodman.
Bejo, possibly.
Bejo, okay. John Goodman I can do. James Cromwell I can do. Penelope Ann Miller I can do. Missy Pyle I can do. And the cast goes on. Basically, there's Malcolm McDowell's in it. There's a whole bunch of people in there. When you watch it, you'll actually see all their faces and you'll know. Now, I do have a trailer, but we're not going to play it because it occurred to me that this is a silent black and white movie. And the trailer is a silent black and white trailer.
Yeah.
So for an audio show, this is all you're going to get. And it goes on just like that for another minute and a half. So
I listen to that all day.
Yeah, so could I. It's really great. But, you know, you're not getting any of the visuals on this show, so it kind of makes it pointless. So that's it. That's the trailer you're going to get. Who's going to start us off? Richard, you're the film wanker amongst us. What did you think of The Artist?
Look, I loved it. We've had two films this year for us, last year for the States, that have paid tribute to an era of cinema, and the other one's been Hugo, mm-hmm. which we've spoken about before. And both of them beautiful and brilliant in their own way. Now, this film, obviously, and you've referred to it before, David, as a gimmick, and in some ways that's true. It is. I prefer to think of it as the kind of the vessel in which they've decided to do this story, because we've already had this era of silent to sound covered so well in the damn near perfect Singin' in the Rain, which is probably my favorite film of all time. So to me, if you're going to do this era again, you have to have a reason to do it again.
And we should stress, for those who are listening, that's our opening clip as well, with Singin' in the Rain.
Yes.
So we've already done this. So.
One of my favorite clips from that film. Look how sweet talked on everybody. to me, this is, the whole film is actually a tribute not just a silent era, not just to yesteryear, but to cinema generally. And you'll probably notice in there obvious things like the theme from Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo during the climactic scenes.
Yep.
But little things. I mean, the narrative is very, very similar to A Star Is Born. You know, there's just so many little visual cues throughout the film. References to Singin' in the Rain as well.
Hmm.
John Goodman's performance is very similar to the producer in that film as well.
Hmm.
But to me, everything about the film is just wonderful. It's just, I don't know, it's a joy. To me, I found it was a joy. And I could not get the sloppy grin off my face most of the time I was watching this film. And it's your brain does switch gears in the first 10 minutes, because watching a silent film is a very different language to watch a film in.
Yep.
And once your brain switched gears to do that, you just enjoy this as though it's anything else. And it's just such a – the performances are what make it. And Jean Dujardin and Bernice Bayer are just wonderful. I mean, she's beautiful, and it's so expressive.
Oh, she's gorgeous.
And he has already been called George Clooney of Europe for obvious reasons. I mean, he is such a charming man in the film. he's so suave, you know. And they're just a joy to watch. And, I mean, you get the pleasure of this. You get so much emotion out of it with no words, which except for there's, you know, a couple of lines of dialogue. But that's it.
Fantastic. Josh, what did you think?
Oh, exactly the same. Funnily enough, my earliest remembrances of film were actually at my grandma and granddad's house, and they had a whole collection of old films, like that era. And I used to go through them because there was nothing else. No offense, guys, but there was nothing else to do at their house. And look, it's true. And like, so I went through films like this, and I have a particular love for black and white early cinema. And this is exactly what I got. It's like the love for me came immediately. Like, I didn't have the thing Richard had the second that the first opening music started playing and someone walked out on stage. I was just there. I was in, and I was totally this film's bitch for the whole film. Any emotion that there was, I was feeling it. Any sort of drama that they were trying to sell, I was feeling it. And I adored this film. I wish it had come out last year so I could have put it in my list.
Yeah, me too.
Fantastic. All right, so I actually did say a couple of weeks ago that I thought it was a gimmick. Now that I've actually seen the film, I actually retract that statement, because I think the film is actually definitely has something to say, and it is a beautiful homage to cinema. It's a beautiful homage to a time, and I think that it was necessary to do it in this way. And I think without spoiling anything, the last couple of minutes of this film make the entire purpose of the silent film mean something.
Absolutely. And
it's no longer, at that point, you no longer go, oh, we're not doing this just to be fun or just to be, there is a meaning behind this. This is a beautifully put together film. I do agree with Richard, though, that I think that as far as homages to old cinema, I think Hugo does it a little bit better. Just purely, I think there's something slightly more magical about Hugo, even though this is a magical film as well. There is something slightly more magical about Hugo for me. And I'm not sure can't quite put my finger on it at this point, what it is. But I do love the cast in this. I love the humor in this film. And I love how clever it is. I love there's little bits and pieces we'll talk about in spoilers, which I think are really, really clever uses of the image. As well. And I'll see if some of you guys picked up on some of these little bits and pieces that I'm thinking of. I really loved it. I thought it was a really good film. And I thought, you're right. He is, Jean Dujardin is just fabulous. That smile and the eyebrow everywhere, you know, when he stops and looks in mirrors and just smiles at himself.
Yeah. Well, we've forgotten the other star performer of the film, which is the dog.
Oh, and
thank
the dog.
You.
Yeah, the dog is fabulous. Now, I also want to... yes, I also want to do a shout out to Missy Pyle, who I love as well. For those who don't know who Missy Pyle is, she was in Galaxy Quest amongst many films, but she was in Galaxy Quest. She was the tall, strange alien who fell in love with Tony Shalhoub.
Monk.
Yeah, Monk, exactly. And I thought she was wonderful, and she's always been kind of odd. And she plays his co-star in the opening film that they're playing, and
that scene between them is fantastic.
Absolutely, where she's trying to get a bow on stage, and it's just fabulous. And I love her. I love
I thought that role was very inspired by Singing in the Rain, the character who speaks at the start of the show today.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I love also there's a reaction, and this isn't really spoiling it, but there's a reaction when he gets brought in to see a talkie. And it's her talking, and he just starts laughing.
Yeah.
And you're left to think, what does she actually sound like?
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, no, I thought this was a really, really fun film. Now, the bigger question that is on my lips at the moment is, do we think it is the film of the year? Now, it has been nominated for a million Academy Awards. It has won the Golden Globe already. It's probably going to win the BAFTA. What we're basically saying here is everybody is saying that this is the film of the year. Is it the film of the year?
I have the simplest answer to this. You guys are the you're the watcher of all the films and the members of everything. As far as films go that have left with the most emotion, there are only two films this year in this bracket of the year, you know, sort of going back 9-10 months or whatever, that I can say that I've had that sort of effect, and that's that and The Muppets. And unfortunately, I'm really sorry, Richard, I couldn't put The Muppets at the top, so I'm going to say yes, and that's me, I'm done.
Okay, Richard, do you think this is the film of the year?
Look, you know, it's been a year when we've had, I mean, my two films that I saw last year that I put at the top of my list were Tree of Life and Melancholia, and very different types of film, so it's sort of hard to compete against that. I loved this film, and if I was looking at an overall film to the year, even if I do think Hugo does the era better, I think this is a better film because I felt more joy out of it. I don't know if I'd say it is the best film of the year, because I don't think you can ever conclusively say that except for the purpose of lists, because we all love a list.
We all do,
But... yeah, look, you know, in terms of the ones that are competing at the moment, I would say yes.
Interesting.
In terms of my personal favorites, Well, that's a different story. We know I love the Muppets.
I'm not sure if I think it's the film of the year. That's the only, I don't even have a film to say, no, this is better. I'm just not sure if I think it's the film of the year.
But the thing is, I mean, look, this is all just in terms of these competitions and things like that that come out. And yes, Best Picture winner does sort of necessarily imply that it's the best film of the year, as voted by a group of people. It's got a whole lot of momentum behind it. It's one of those things. I think Hollywood's loving it, and everyone's loving it because it says so much about Hollywood cinema, because it says so much about an era, because it's such a nostalgic film, and people, there's nothing about it you can particularly dislike.
That's true.
Can I just bring up one thing, by the way? What was Malcolm McDowell doing in that film? Does anybody
the hell he wants to do? He's Malcolm McDowell.
That's right.
Well, that was what I said when somebody asked me that question. But yeah, no, he was in there for so short a time. He was in there for like 3 seconds.
You know what? The stories behind this. I mean, who knows? He's probably friends with the director, and the director probably said, "I'm making this film. Do you want to sit there in the chair?"
He was probably just on set.
He probably didn't know there was a camera on him. he was probably just there for lunch. Because you know what? It didn't matter what he said.
He was in between Halloween films.
Oh, that's cold, man. Yeah. All right. So I think we can all pretty much agree that this is a recommended viewing film. Yes. And everybody should go out and see this because it is just a really charming, fun film. And yes, we know it's black and white. We know it's silent. Suck it up. Go see
so
it.
You've been warned. Don't be like the people in the UK and storm out because you weren't warned.
Exactly. So let's do a little bit of a spoiler section because there's actually a couple things I just want to ask you about and talk about. So, Richard, do you have a Claxton?
I do.
All right. So we're in a spoiler zone now, and as usual... we'll put the time codes in the show notes. So if you... don't want to hear this part, fast forward. Okay, so, all right. So, one thing I want to ask you guys about. There's a scene in it where he wakes up in the middle of the night and it goes sepia tone.
Yep.
Yep, which I thought was really clever anyway. I wasn't quite sure why it went sepia tone, whether or not it was just like the film was supposed to be being degraded or something like that. It was just another homage thing. I thought maybe it was supposed to be like a mark of progress. I wasn't quite sure what they were quite getting there. But the next shot, which was him talking to John Goodman in the office, was the one I wanted to actually talk about because I don't know if it was just a trick of the light, but I watched it so closely because it was fascinating me. But did any of you seem to notice that the scene was still mildly sepia tone throughout that entire conversation, except him? He was still black and white.
There's a lot of that throughout the film, and I think that that's it's yeah. No, I think and there's one of my favourite sequences in the film is where he, after he's first gone and seen that sound test you mentioned before, he puts down the glass and it makes a sound.
When I first saw that, I thought that was fourth wall breaking. I actually thought that that was a joke for us.
It is,
and that
yeah.
it was going to pass. No, I thought that it was going to pass. Like it was going to be like he'd put it down and everything would be normal. And then as it kind of breaks in, it actually became pretty terrifying.
Oh, it is. It really is.
Yeah, that's a great sequence. It's actually my favorite sequence in the film. Just how it builds. And he gets louder and louder and louder and louder. And he's literally freaking out by all of this. I think that's just an amazing sequence. But yeah, so did anybody notice him being in black and white?
No, I didn't notice that.
Because I thought maybe I was going crazy at one point because nobody else seemed to notice this either. I got to see the film again just to see if I'm right about that.
But we had a really bad screening of the film involving sound and picture issues, so I wasn't looking for things like that because I just thought it was the retarded guy doing the cinema work. Sorry to whoever you were. I'm sure it wasn't your fault.
That's fair enough. Are we allowed to use that word nowadays? I don't know if it's the politically correct word.
We're really not, no.
We're really not.
You'd be retarded if you used that word.
Yeah, okay. You two are going to get me taken off the air. No, I'm not. It's a podcast. We can do whatever we want.
Yay! I keep forgetting I've actually got that on my soundboard.
Oh, no, I'll play one for you. How's this one? Woo! All right. Thank you. All right. I also wanted to talk about the finale, which is where we finally get sound. Overdone or just right?
Just right, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
One of the guys that saw it with us actually said that he thought it might just be a little bit overdone.
No, but that was the era. That was the thing. That was how you finished a movie in that period of time. It was all bam and glamour, and it's like you wanted to leave the cinema cheering, and that's the way you're supposed to leave. That's the way you're supposed to leave a film like that, and I disagree with that wholeheartedly.
I was actually surprised, and I the more I thought about it, the more I realized that it was probably going to be pushing a friendship just a little bit too far. But were either of you expecting it to go color?
No.
Because it was the right era. They would have done the first, because, you know, he just finally came to terms with talking and the sound, and then they would have gone, hey, we're doing color next. You know what I mean?
That would have been too much. And I would have think that would have walked it over the edge.
Yeah. No, I think it was because it was more about him, and, you know, they represented his whole
transition.
Yeah. Exactly. And they represented that as silent to sound, and you knew that from that sequence where it's, as you said, it's nightmarish, him not able to speak in a world full of sound.
Mm-hmm.
So for him to actually just say anything at the end of that movie was the perfect. It was him perfectly accepting that new world, and that he does actually have a place in it. And I thought the gag that they both had strong French accents.
Well, I think that was perfect, actually, because it kind of explained why he couldn't fit into the talking world.
Yeah.
Mm.
And it was perfect. It was just when he finally spoke, he went, aha. It was the Rudolph Valentino. It was the Rudolph Valentino thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know? Well, his character's name is Georges Valentin.
Absolutely. Perfect. So, yeah. And can we also just mention, while we're in spoilers, how tragic was the film that he made?
Oh.
It was fantastic. What are you talking about? That line where he's sinking in the hole? He's like, I never loved you. I thought that was fantastic.
And then it comes up with the end, and you go, really, that's the film you made?
Actually, speaking of tragic, while we're also in spoilers, the I mentioned it before, the Vertigo theme, and when he's about to kill himself,
yep.
They're playing the Vertigo theme music up to that. Now, Kim Novak came out and said that she felt, and I'm quoting here, she felt that she had been. I felt as if my body, or at least my body of work, has been violated by the movie.
Oh, come on.
She stated that rape had been committed in regard to the musical score. Now, Michelle, as unofficious, has actually said that no, this is a love letter to cinema. So there's all sorts of things that were inspired by Hitchcock, Lang, Ford, Lubitsch, and so forth. So that was just one of them. Now, did you think that using another score there was over the top?
Not at all. I thought that was pitch perfect because it's paying homage. That's the whole point.
Yeah. No, I agree. But some people actually did feel as though an original score would have served the film better there. I actually think it was. I couldn't think of anything better than to actually have one of the most famous scores.
It's cheeky.
It's cheeky.
That's what you're supposed to do in a film like that. Exactly. It's supposed to be cheeky. And it's supposed to be that little, like, for the people that actually know anything about cinema. There you go.
And you know what? I get so fed up with this because people are so precious about one thing, and then in another situation where it's got nothing to do with them, they sit there and go, oh, that's genius. If we all remember Peter Weir's film, The Truman Show, his soundtrack for The Truman Show was applauded. Everybody talked about how absolutely wonderful the soundtrack was to that film. And yet half the score was lifted from Philip Glass's Koyaanisqatsi and Mishima. And you sit there and go, yeah, but you're not talking about the fact that you actually just leave. I mean, and they didn't steal it or rewrite it. It's actually on the album. It says by Philip Glass from the film Mishima. It was completely unoriginal. They used it because it fit nicely. And everybody talked about how wonderful that score was. You know? So I sit there and go, you know, you can't have it both ways.
Yeah.
You know, so I think if you're paying homage to something, in particular in this situation, I think it's perfectly suitable.
Agreed.
Anyway, we guys have to move on because I just looked at the time. I thought we got to get through a list of five. Yep. You guys got any more you got any more spoilers you want to add before we leave the spoiler zone?
Yes. Nope. The only one I wanted to add was the awesome scene between, where the main character instills the use of his dog to try and win over his wife. And they both do the same movements at the same timepiece.
Yeah.
I melted.
I loved that.
I was like, that was amazing. Yeah. But anyway, that's it.
I loved that dog. I loved every movement that dog made. I love the fact that it kept burying its head in the ground.
Yeah.
I just thought that was fabulous. It would just kind of stick its butt up in the air and hold its head in the ground with its paws over its head. It's like, no. Terrific stuff. Richard, you got anyone you want to throw out there?
No, nope, that's it for me.
In that case, play us the Claxton. we're out, and we can now say that we are going to do our amazing list of five. I say amazing because I was having trouble with this one. This week's list of five is in honor of the artist. We're going to do five homage movies. Now, this interpret this list any way you want, guys. All right, it's basically films that pay homage in some way or another. And this week, I'm going to start us off. Because you guys always start. So I'm going to start this week. And I'm going to say my number five, you got to have one on your list because he is the homage man. And I'm going to say Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds. Because let's face it, the opening 20 minutes of that film, if in particular, is just a Sergio Leone film.
Yeah.
The way it's shot, the way it's paced, everything about that is a Sergio Leone film. And I thought magnificently done. It's actually the best part of the entire film.
Yes.
Richard, your number five.
Hudsucker Proxy, which is
a little Coen higher Brothers on film. My list.
a homage to screwball comedies, amongst many other things.
I'll come back to that. I'll make mention of it later on because it is a bit higher on my list. No, I love that film. Love it. You know, for kids. Josh, your number five.
My number five is one which is soon to be vaulted, but it's Behind the Mask, Rise of Leslie Vernon, which is a homage to anything that is 80s horror films.
Absolutely. I did think about that at one point. It's a great film. You put me onto that. I really like that. All right. My number four is Darkman, the Sam Raimi film, which is basically an homage to old B-movies. To old B monster movies in particular, including bad rear back projection and the whole bit. It's wonderful in its glorious badness. All right, Richard, and number four.
Number four, I couldn't choose between a Tarantino or a Robert Rodriguez, so I chose one that they both worked on, which was Grindhouse.
Fair enough. Absolutely.
Which is really two movies all in one, but in its original format, it's. Well, it's an homage to Grindhouse, isn't it?
Absolutely. No doubt about that. Josh, your number four.
My number four is Dead Snow, which is like old Peter Jackson films and zombie horror films done with a whole lot of love, including people wearing the t-shirts that actually say things like brain dead.
I love that film. You and I watched that together. That was fantastic. Yeah. all right. My number three is an old Mel Brooks movie. Funnily enough, in homage to the artist, I think Mel Brooks did it first, quite frankly, with Silent Movie, when he actually did a comedy and did the entire thing as a silent film. And a piece of trivia for you, what is the only word uttered in that film?
No idea.
The only word uttered in that film, spoiler for a film that's 35 years old, but the only word uttered in the film is no, and it's uttered by the famous mime, Marceau Marceau. very funny film. Richard, your number three.
I just literally changed my number three right now because I just thought of another movie that I didn't include. And I've changed it to The Great Muppet Caper because I wanted to include a Muppets film in there because all the Muppets films are homages to something. And this is a great homage to all classic caper films, really.
And like Dashiell Hammett and stuff. It's fantastic.
And Hammett. Yeah. And also big Broadway musicals as well because, you know, it opens with a song called Hey, a Movie.
Absolutely. Josh, your number three.
My number three is a cheat, but I don't care because I couldn't decide between the two of them, so I put them both on the list. Kill Bill Part 1.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm not going to tell you where it is or what part, where it is in the order, but Kill Bill Part 1 is at number three.
Fair enough. I go with that. As I say, we all had to have a Tarantino on there somewhere.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. My number two is the Hudsucker Proxy. I think this is a masterpiece of homage to films like His Girl Friday and so forth. And I'm right there with Richard. I think this is terrific stuff. And I think out of everybody in that film, the person who embraced it the most was Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Her character is terrific. She's really got that Katharine Hepburn thing down pat.
Katharine Hepburn / Rosalind Russell / fast talking. You know, yeah, we're doing it now. See,
I love that. It's my favorite era of comedy as well.
Absolutely, it's terrific stuff, and the Coens just captured it perfectly. Okay, your number two, Richard.
My number two was Woody Allen's Stardust Memories.
Oh, good choice. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, which itself is it's like an homage within an homage within an homage. This one, it's kind of his 8.5 in a way. For Fellini's 8.5, so it's sort of like a tribute to that.
We like the early funny movies.
Yeah, exactly. But it's also a parody of his own films, but a parody of more serious films. I almost included Love and Death,
yes,
which was Woody Allen's tribute to Dostoevsky and the Russian classics. Wheat, tremendous amounts of wheat. But I included this one because it's just it sort of captures that thing, but it's also a filmmaker's tribute to filmmaking.
You could almost use Purple Rose of Cairo as well.
I almost did, but yeah. I've used it before, I think, in our color list, and I didn't want to vault it just yet.
Yeah, but Woody Allen is an absolute minefield of this stuff. So,
exactly.
Josh, your number two.
My number two is a film called Severance.
I've never seen it.
Yeah, probably not the best film in the world, but it does two things. It homages to a lot of camera work and scenes done from kind of suspense horrors and thrillers, and then just takes the piss out of them. It's brilliant.
Yeah,
really have to watch it.
I'll have to have a look at it. Sounds good. All right, number ones. Ready for a round of number ones?
Absolutely.
Let's see how we all go with this. My number one is Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I had a guess it might have been.
Yeah, look, I mean, this is the ultimate homage to the cliffhanger serials of its day, and probably done pitch perfect. A terrific film, really liked it, and I don't think there's anybody in the world who didn't. So I think enough said. Richard, you're number two.
Yeah,
number one.
Look, it's an almost flawless film, but I think that what is a flawless film is my number one is Singing in the Rain.
Of course.
Which is my favorite, which also my favorite film of all time. So we had to include it in there.
Fair enough. And Josh, bring us home.
To stand up against Singing in the Rain. Seriously. mine is Kill Bill Part 2.
There you go.
Which is to me one of again, it's the love for that kind of films that this film takes out that just makes it push straight to the top of my list. I'm not a huge Tarantino fan. That's the funny thing. It's like I do like the films that he makes, but I don't go on about them like other people do. But I felt Kill Bill deserved two representations because that was a really good piece of cinema work.
All right, let's do just a quick round. We've got a couple minutes left over before this show finishes, so I just want to do a quick rundown on this. Until we finally see, and apparently it's made, we just haven't got it here yet, Kill Bill, The Whole Bloody Affair. Which is the whole film cut into one. Until we get that, at this point in time, what is the preferred half of Kill Bill? Because they are two very different films.
Well, mine's pretty obvious.
Yeah, well Josh has just done it. I was for the longest time the first one because I thought it was the cooler of the two. It's the faster pace. It's the one that sort of hits you over the head immediately. And the second one I thought was a little bit flatter, but when you take them together, it works quite well. I do actually now prefer the second one simply because I'm such a huge Western fan, and I think his homage to the Western is as much as Tarantino can be more subtle than in Kill Bill Part One, because in Kill Bill Part One he wholesale lifts scenes out of like Lady Snowblood and Sex and not Sex and Zen, I think it's called Sex and Death, and a whole lot of the Pinky Violence films. Like I watched a bunch of them. The more films you watch, the more unoriginal you realize Tarantino actually is.
Tarantino is completely unoriginal. Josh and I were having this conversation the other day. The man is a walking homage. And I said to Josh, I'm actually waiting for the day that he actually makes something original. I'm kind of waiting for the day that he goes, let's try something that isn't somebody else's work, you know.
Exactly,
what I mean? Because he does.
Ironically, I think
really
Jackie
well.
Brown came the closest, even though it was an adaptation. It didn't feel like it was necessarily a Tarantino.
Yeah, but he was still aping other people's style.
He was still aping other people's style. Inglourious Basterds is really great, but I think it's only great because I haven't seen all the films that he's aping.
Well, see, I've seen a lot of them, and I was watching it sitting there going, I can recognize that. Like that, as I said, that opening 20 minutes, that farmer and washing himself and the big wide shots, this is straight out of Once Upon a Time in the West. You know, and it's straight out. Absolutely. You know, these sort of shots and this pacing and this style, and you sit there and go, and it's beautiful. It's so well done. He's even got the Ennio Morricone style music playing in the background, and you just sit there and go, I know exactly what you're doing, and you're doing it incredibly well. But one day, I just want to see Tarantino cut loose and say, I'm going to trust myself and see if I can do it. You know what I mean? And I don't know. I don't know if he can. I think he is so ingrained in his passion for everything else, I don't know if he actually is capable of producing something original.
I think he still says, like, he still mentions the fact that he worked in a video store constantly. I don't think he's ever gotten past it. You know that video store clerk when you go in and they want to tell you everything they know about movies?
It used to be me. Cool. Yeah, it used to be me. Yeah, I worked in a video store for 13 years. I know exactly what that's like.
And you know, and it just, it's kind of like, I don't think he ever got over that, and he still wants to let you know, I've seen this obscure movie that you haven't seen, and I saw it before you did, and you can't get it anymore, but I've got the 35mm at home. He still wants to be that guy.
Yeah, and I was never quite that bad.
Yeah, and I just think, because I was complaining about this on the weekend, because I saw this article on some indie website saying, oh yes, Chronicle is good, but it's not as good as, I can't even remember what the film was, but it's a film that, you know, no one's had access to this year, but it's been playing at a couple of festivals. It's kind of like, well, no one's really going to notice because it hasn't actually had a wide release. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You know, he's that guy. He's that guy who's constantly going, you know, I know about films and I'm going to throw every footnote I've ever learned into this film. And that's great. I'm glad that he knows a lot about films, because I think a good filmmaker is a good film watcher. But I think a good homage is not necessarily just aping that thing wholesale.
Yeah,
I mean,
you know what the difference
Reservoir Dogs, it's City on Fire.
Yeah, but you know what the difference is as well? The difference is that Martin Scorsese is a massive movie watcher. Martin Scorsese knows everything about everything to know with anything to do with cinema. And yet, when you watch a Martin Scorsese film, you are watching a Martin Scorsese film. And he has a distinct style that he's had since day one, and he's always had his own mark. You know, and that's what the one thing that Tarantino doesn't have. Tarantino films look like Tarantino films because we recognize them in other things.
You know, it's interesting.
And that's what I'm saying. I love Tarantino. Don't get me wrong. I love Tarantino films because I love all that homage. And I love I love his coolness factors and so forth. And I never answered the question, by the way. I actually like Kill Bill Volume 2 better than Volume 1. I think Volume 1 has that absolute show-stopping fight scene in the middle of it at the club. With the bloodbath, and I think that is really, really fantastic, and I admire the fact that he did it without CG, and it was all practical and everything else. But the second film is where Tarantino thrives, and that's with his dialogue. And he actually goes back to characters, and that's one thing that Tarantino writes phenomenally well. And that entire speech with Carradine talking about Superman and his secret identity is one of my favorite monologues ever. You know, it's just a fantastic monologue. So, I mean, I love his work, but it always fascinates me that he is considered this god of cinema, and yet he really isn't original in anything he does.
No, and in fact, even his closest contemporary, which would be Robert Rodriguez, has turned out at least twice the work that he has, and he's been very patchy. But you could at least say that Rodriguez has tried to develop some of his own original stuff in there along the way.
I think you can spot a Rodriguez film. More than
you can try it, because he has a style. You know, he makes it. I mean, look, you know, El Mariachi is far more original than Reservoir Dogs was.
But I think that's the problem. He's got to the point where he's actually kind of painted himself into a cliche of being this film critic and of being this film lover. So for him to do something different is going to be analyzed so much harder than something like Rodriguez, because Rodriguez went, the easiest way out of this is to paint myself as someone that can do really crap films as well.
I was going to say, I agree with you, but I think the problem is he's a filmmaker who cares about what people think about him, and that's the worst place to be.
I think
if you're going to be a filmmaker, you have to be fearless.
I bring up another example of somebody who is like that, maybe not so much anymore, but was very much like that, Kevin Smith.
Yeah.
Way too worried about what other people think of him. And it's death to a career.
No, absolutely. But again, he's got to the point where it's, excuse the gaming phrase for a minute, but he's almost Duke Nukem Forever, the concept of being able to do that, because he's pushed himself so far and he's had all these amazing hits doing the style of taking other people's films and creating a homage film that I think he's literally going to never be able to make the film that he would want to make.
Very possible.
It's never going to happen.
It's interesting, though. I was talking to a really, really, really big fan of Tarantino the other day, and he was saying, after Django Unchained, it's going to be really interesting because that's the last script that we know about that Tarantino's had been kicking around for ages and talking about.
That's true.
All of these others, like Inglourious Basterds, been around forever, and Django Unchained's been around forever. They're both out there now. They're both, you know, being made or in production or being worked on. Whatever he does after that is going to be his first thing that he hasn't been cradling for forever and talking about, because he will talk about the stuff that he's working on.
That's true. Well, he can't help but talk about it. That's very true, Richard. He hasn't got anything. He hasn't got any more juice. He hasn't got any more gas in the tank, does he?
No. So whatever he does next will either be maybe somebody else's script, which would be lovely to see, just see him purely as a director.
Although I don't know if I want to see that, because one of his strongest
dialogue, of course,
is his writing. He's a great writer, and you know, I'd rather see him write and other people take his material for.
But to me, his strongest script was one where he worked on it with somebody else, which was Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
So I'd like to see him collaborate more.
And I actually really liked when he wrote True Romance and somebody else took it over.
Actually, I'd like to see him write and someone else interpret, because I still love Natural Born Killers, and I know a lot of people don't, but I actually still think there's a lot to love about that film.
So, yeah, there is something to be said about him just being a writer for hire for a while as well. Anyway, we're out of time, guys. I just want to get your opinions on that, because I was very curious. The two sides of Kill Bill have been around for a long time, and then I've never spoken to you guys about it, so I was very curious. All right, Josh, where can people find out more about you on the internet?
RawDLC.com is a gaming website. Head over there and check it out. And, stuff.
Richard,
I love the stuff, man.
Where can people find out more about you, Richard?
Oh, they can find me at therealbits.com. That's the RWELbits.com. And there you can link out to all my stuff, including my Twitter at DVDBits.
Are you on it right now?
I'm actually not.
Oh, really?
It's really dark in here.
It's really dark in here.
Okay, and you can find out more about me by going to geekactually.com, where you can find a follow us link, which will take you to everything we do, which is, well, you know, Facebook pages and all sorts of stuff. I also forgot to mention that if you agree or disagree with anything we do on this show, send your feedback to feedback@filmactually.com, or you can leave us a voicemail at 02-801-13167 or Skype ID geekactually, all one word. Quick shout quick shout outs to two of our friends out there in the cyberspace land. That would be the Real Junkies podcast over at weekendronin.com, or search for them on iTunes, R-E-E-L, just like you, Richard.
Yay!
And
it's a good name.
It is a good name. And of course, Charlie and Brad over at Rebound Radio. They do a whole bunch of shows, which I'm not going to list off right now, but they're really good. Go have a listen to them. That's it. That's a show. We're done. We opened with that clip from Singing in the Rain. We're going to close the show with some music from The Artist, which is a really wonderful score, which I think is great. Have you guys got anything to add to this mess?
What?
only that... No, I haven't actually.
No, nothing? Okay. Well, in that case, I'm going to say go see more movies. You don't see enough movies, and all of life's questions are answered in the movies, and we'll see you all next week. Bye, guys.
Bye.